for April 9th, 2024. I'm Steve Fodor.
Steve, did we survive?
We're here. Well, we're podcasting. Maybe we're okay.
The eclipse was yesterday. The world went away, and it came back.
The sun went away, and it came back.
And it came back.
The world was still here, I think.
We're all anew. It is a blessing to be here, Steve.
We are renewed by our adventures in the field, seeing the eclipse.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. You found another one, Chip. You found a movie that I really want to seek this one out. You saw a movie called Wicked Little Letters. Tell us all about this one.
Well, Steve, it's a Sony Pictures classic.
I don't know that it's a Sony Pictures classic. It's from Sony, but it's British.
It definitely is. It's very much a Sony Pictures classic in all the lovely, lovely ways. We should tell them about the story, Steve.
Okay, so tell us the story.
So it's based off a true story. There was a lady who moved from Ireland to a place in England. And the next door neighbor started receiving dirty letters in the mail. So this takes place during, I don't know, maybe the 1800s. What we have is, well, not only is our neighbor getting dirty letters, and they think it's this Irish woman who's loud and bawdy and boisterous and all that other fun stuff, but other neighbors start receiving those too. And there is an investigation by the police, Steve. There's an investigation by the police, and there's a woman constable, Steve.
Okay.
And she doesn't think that our new lady is writing those dirty letters to all the other neighbors. This is based on a true story.
Okay.
And it kind of is a Sherlock Holmes type story.
Okay.
They have to trace down who that person is. It's a whodunit. And then we come to the ending and we find out who did it. And it's very interesting.
But this is a very bawdy British comedy. This is not a Sony Pictures classic, like quiet sitting, sipping tea. This is very bawdy.
Oh.
And very silly.
Steve, I watched it.
It's Monty Python.
No.
Okay.
No. No, but this is lovely. This is a fun picture. You're going to the picture, Steve, and this is certainly. I don't think this is going to appeal to our youngest watchers.
Okay.
But certainly to adults, PBS adults.
Aha.
They would certainly enjoy this. I would say 65 out of 100. It's
okay.
Enjoyable, and certainly you'll know many of the actors.
Stars Olivia Colman. She's in everything.
Yes. And people are fainting because they're receiving these dirty letters. Once again, hilarious. Certainly from a different time. You realize how poor everyone was at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then just the ability to have people, live on top of each other. And it's after the, in fact, it's early. It's after World War I really where it takes place. Listen, I enjoyed it. The two other people in there, the older couple in there with me, they enjoyed it too, Steve.
Fun, silly mystery.
And you know what it wasn't? Kong versus Godzilla, which I didn't see. And I'm glad I didn't, because that was my alternative, Steve.
The other thing that you saw was Steve, !, Martin, :, a documentary in two pieces. This is on Apple TV Plus, and it's the Steve Martin documentary.
It is the documentary of Steve Martin. Now, Steve, you and I grew up at a time where Steve Martin was, it was after he was the rock and roll comedian.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't know him from Laugh-In.
Correct.
We didn't know him from when he got started in Disney and all those other.
Or Knott's Berry Farm before that.
Sure. But we grew up with him as he was becoming. He had left comedy. We had his albums we could listen to over and over and over. In fact, that was one of my epiphanies when I'm sitting here watching this. There was a talent show at George Mason University. A talent show. A guy went up and did a full set of Steve Martin material.
Uh-huh.
And he got laughs. Of course he did. Because Steve Martin came after Vietnam and everything serious and political. And he's just this silly, goofy comedian who's playing the part of a comedian. And we are playing the part of the audience. And when and how much work it took him to find his voice.
Very different.
How the rise of Saturday Night Live, where he goes, oh my goodness, there's a team of people who are seeing the world as I'm seeing. How that really kind of exploded. And then ultimately, why he walked away from it. There's your first part of this documentary. And Steve Martin, at that time, was anxiety-ridden. He certainly had self-doubt. He grew up with a father who he loves and he came to really respect, but really had a hard time showing, like, you know, when Steve Martin's first movie, The Jerk, came out, his father said something like, well, that wasn't Charlie Chaplin. You know, it's amazing. You have failed. You're not the president of the United States. You know, it's comparing someone to something that's unattainable at the moment. It's not fair.
Right.
And anyway, just recognize the words that you use with the love young people around them. In fact, the words you use with anyone around you, be very conscious of. Because later on in the second part of the documentary, where he's having this conversation with Jerry Seinfeld, he says something like, I don't feel comfortable criticizing other people. Now, Steve, we read books and we watch movies and we are...
Critical.
But I listen, I don't want anybody to ever feel like they shouldn't exist.
Correct.
I'm, you know, critiquing somebody's art or, you know, how this played out, many times it's not in their control. I mean, think about Dakota Johnson with Madame Web. And she thought it was part of the MCU. It wasn't. She thought it was going to be better, and it wasn't. That was beyond her control. Or how about Bill Murray with Garfield?
He made a mistake. He thought it was being directed by one person, but it was being directed by somebody else, and it was not a good movie in a lot of ways. Being critical of that, being able to criticize it, is important. But yes, not going to the extent that we are going to use the negativity toward that person who's... work was out of their control sometimes.
I also want to bring up this. So Steve Martin had The Jerk, and then eventually we know him for like Cheaper by the Dozen and movies like that. But in between there, you know, he did Roxanne, which was his first piece of, when I say timeless art, you know, he's telling a story that's been told us before, but he's certainly telling in a contemporary atmosphere. And it, you know, it just seemed to reflect him of that time. He followed that up with L.A. Story, which is another very interesting love story, light, certainly reflected him very, very well. I think this is a trilogy because he had a play that he wrote called Wasp, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, that I think really, I'm sorry, I've never seen Wasp.
I've never seen it either.
But I certainly had a lot of interest. In fact, I'm going to go on YouTube and see if there's a copy of it out there and see if there's a way we can watch it. In fact, keep a lookout for a local theater production of it. But it really is a story about a family and maybe the discontent of just being present, but not being present. Not, you know, there's a conversation in this documentary. Steve Martin is such a wealth of human discovery. He understands himself and has grown so much. But deep down, he says, our family wasn't a family that talked at the table. And he I think he longed for, like he would go to people's houses and there's dinner and everybody's talking and sharing stories and all this other stuff and what it really meant for him. And I just ask about your life. Are you a person who invites conversation, invites ideas to be shared, or you're a person who shuts it down? I think his play, Wasp, addresses some of these ways that we, I don't know, some of our backgrounds impact how we view ourselves in the world. Why are you more reserved than someone else? Why are you, you know, more out there than something else? That's the beauty of discovering a different culture. And you go, ah, this is how they do it. we should probably learn from it.
What an interesting theme to our show today, because our book certainly goes to some of those similar themes, and our special guest in the Scroll With It segment. We'll get there as well.
So you can watch us on Apple TV Plus. It is very long. I mean, it truly is two movies.
Okay.
But certainly worthy of your time, especially if you like Steve Martin.
Which I do.
And I think that you will leave this liking him even more. He really is a genuine person, a very well-rounded person whose priorities have changed. And I didn't know he was married and had a daughter.
Interesting.
So there you go.
Interesting. Book it. Brings us to our book it, our book of the week. Chip, I randomly picked up a book and I fell in love with it and I asked you to read it, knowing full well that you wouldn't be the same viewpoint as me and wouldn't love it nearly as much, and that's okay. This is a book called Chicago. It was published in 2016 by Brian Doyle, and it is an intriguing look at a Chicago that maybe never existed.
Well, you know, that was part of the story is it is a Chicago that is an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a slice of life kind of experiencing it. And so we've got this guy who moves to Chicago and immediately adopts the White Sox, gets to know all the people in the building. Just basically, he drinks in what, you know, if you were telling someone about Chicago and what it would be like to live in Chicago, I think that you've got your story.
Yeah. And he uses such a quirky style that is suited to the energy of mysticism. There's something about this story that is beyond reality. There's a dog in
this story. A well-read dog, Steve.
A very well-read, very intentional soul who happens to be a dog that is a big part of this story. Is this a talking dog? No, but this is a soul that the author was connecting with on such a level that he writes this character as an important part of his ideal of Chicago.
Well, Steve, he loves Carl Sandburg and, of course, Abraham Lincoln, and he really loves the Lincoln stuff he wrote in Springfield and not so much the stuff on the national stage.
Don't you love it? I love the way that this author creates that character and uses those details for this character who does not talk, who is a dog.
And how does a man that green have the blues that bad, Steve?
The blues. The Chicago Blues are a big part of my life. You know that. You know how much time I've spent with the Blues Brothers over the years, how much money I've spent on Blues Brothers and blues-related things. The music of the blues speaks to me on such a special level. Brian Doyle writes about that in this book.
And Steve, how did the Sox do today? Because the Chicago White Sox, the scores of the games, the talk of the game, the talk about going to Comiskey, or, you know, Guaranteed Rate Stadium, Steve.
It's Comiskey.
It's just always just present. And why the White Sox and not the Cubs? He talks about that.
Because it's about the people. It's about the people. This book is all about meeting people and catching their stories. Brian Doyle, in this voice of this narrator, who I assume is very similar to Brian Doyle's voice himself, explains that he is a story catcher. He's not a storyteller. He's a journalist whose job it is to go out and find somebody else's story and publish it.
And of course he works for the Sun-Times. Of course he does, Steve. And he's got characters. He's got characters all around him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he's got the neighbor, who is going to tell you why he loves baseball and doesn't love the Bears or the Blackhawks or the basketball the Bulls.
But then we get to the bus driver who loves the Bears.
Go Bears!
This is such a nostalgia trip of a story. The writing style is very different from a lot of things. The voice is so like a journalist, but also a fantasy realm of ways of thinking. It's yeah. so philosophical. I love this story so much.
So it's a breeze to read. I certainly, if you were sitting on, by the way, the ocean, or is it a lake, Steve? Is it a lake or an ocean? You know, it's both. It's the water, man. It's what makes Chicago. Anyway, it seems like if you were sitting out in the warm beach of Lake Michigan, and you needed a light read, a summer read, this would fall right into that.
There's so many great quotes that I just kept writing down. So many great quotes. For every young man, I would guess every young woman too, lives many secret lives between the ages of 15 and 30, and only slightly fewer thereafter. No matter your age and stage, maybe that is healthy and nutritious that we save and appreciate the idiosyncratic charm and unique energy of people we meet. That's the core of this story for me, is meeting the people.
Let me get a tissue.
Meeting people is what we do. That's what we do. That's what you do all day long. You find people and listen to their stories. That's what this book is about.
And I drive people crazy who go with me, right? Because all we do is like, hey, let's meet these new people. Let's continue to meet people. We meet lots of people, Steve.
He says Chicago may be the only American city. What do you think about that quote?
So I think there's something to that. And, mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, if you think of New England, and particularly mm-hmm. New York, New York's an international city. On the most grandest, it is the London of today. And when you start moving to the Midwest, what you're getting is, you know, it's the flyover states, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting to the general population. But this is a big, big mega city. It's different than St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's different than Kansas City. It's different than Omaha. It's just different. And I think that if you were going to write a movie and you were John Hughes, where would you set it, Steve?
I think that John Hughes certainly felt that Americanism that is Chicago. You said New England and New York. The history of those places is not in America. The history of Chicago is the history of America in so many ways because of that moment when those people got to this area and talked to the native people and said, what do you call your land? And they go, why do you talk like that?
Garlic.
What's that? Oh, that's an onion. Okay. Onion land. Got it.
Garlic land, Steve. Garlic land. Speaking of, it brings us back to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours when we read Devil in the White City. And, mm-hmm. and that was where Chicago, with the Chicago World's Fair, that's what the that was one of the stories going on in there, went from being, you know, just a small city to the mega city as it is, overtook Philadelphia as, I think, the second largest city in the United States. Now, we could argue on this because within our lifetime, Dallas will overtake Chicago in population. And you could argue that the Chicago of today could be south. And it could be someplace like Dallas as it continues to grow. But, I mean, as the United States was creating itself, we certainly, this area certainly had its special place in defining the United States.
And that special history and that nostalgia for this particular time in this particular place is on display in this book. The characters are so well written. I know these characters. I know these people. I've met these people in Chicago.
Well, you know, one of the ways to describe them is these people don't have ketchup, Steve.
There's no ketchup on the hot dogs here in Chicago. Welcome to Chicago. Have some food. The food is not really the centerpiece of this story. Surprisingly, when I think of Chicago, I think of food.
Steve, how much time do you have? Listen, he's playing basketball, Steve. He's going to blues concerts.
So many great blues bars.
Like every other chapter, he's going to another blues concert. Come on, man.
And a lot of piano bars. There's some great piano bars, some great blues bars in Chicago. The people are the center, though. That is what I got out of this. That idea of the story catcher is that's who I am. Sure. That's who I am. And that snippet of that part of Chicago at that time, I remember. I remember those places and those things.
So that's Chicago from 2016 by Brian Doyle.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. Chip, I'm smiling a lot right now.
I know. Steve, we just talked about a novel about Chicago.
Uh-huh.
You know, we should learn something about Chicago.
The whole time I was reading Brian Doyle's book about Chicago, I was thinking about one man who stood above the rest, came to us through WTTW, the PBS station here in Chicago, and was my story catcher. This is Ben Hollis of Wild Chicago. Good morning, Ben.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. What an intro. Whoa.
I have to tell you.
Hello, boys and girls.
Okay. I have to tell you how much you influenced my life in those moments that you gave to me through PBS in the late 1980s, the late 1900s, and just your style, your way of running around the streets of Chicago, showing the joy of life here in the city of Chicago, it was a real true inspiration to me.
Wow. Thank you. That's how I remember it. It was, what do you want to know?
Well, let's start off by, you know, for a person who didn't grow up in Chicago.
Yeah.
WTTW is the PBS station. Right. Tell us about the program Wild Chicago.
Yeah. It was some people called it PM Magazine on crack. Okay, now kids, don't take drugs.
It was from the 80s, right?
It was just a really gonzo show, kind of a travelogue around the city and suburbs, designed to take you to places and introduce you to people that a concierge would never dare do. The program director, Dick Bowman, once said, I think people like the show because they feel a sense of danger. Like they get to go to places that they'd never go by themselves, which was just part of it. That was maybe like 20% of the show. The rest of it was places that everybody could. I mean, yeah, the whole point in my mind was choose places that you could actually go to. And so you could go to like there were things you couldn't do. Well, maybe you could. This guy who gave tours under bridges, you know. Not on the river. He would like open up a grate on, say, at Division Street over the river, and climb down this little scaffolding, and he'd give tours under there. And he had a phone number, and this is how you got in touch with people. There was no online, no internet or anything. And I don't know, unusual museums, people's collections, inventors. There was a segment called Wild Neighbor. You probably remember that.
Sure.
Where you got to, you know, meet a person in their own home, and they were recommended by their neighbor as like, this person's interesting, and kind of an oddball, like a guy who collected all these skulls in his house, and he was a school teacher too, by Jove, I think.
it might be a type.
The eccentricity, you know, comes through. But
a cautionary tale to all the children who didn't listen, right?
You know, I mean, I don't know if there's much like it on TV today, because it was very loosely produced, was not slick. Sometimes we'd set up a segment where we'd say, this is not Wild Chicago. And we'd see an exterior of the East Bank Club, which at that time was the most happening, sleek health club there was. We'd say, this is the East Bank Club, definitely not Wild Chicago. We're going to take you here to the Lincoln Turner. I don't know what they call it, Lincoln Turner organization or something, which was like this nasty old, you know, health club, hot tubby place that was falling apart, hadn't changed since the 20s or 30s. Now it's been taken over, actually. It's by the Chicago Lincoln Park Health Club or something. It's fancy now. I mean, I could ramble forever, but that one more thing about this, everything you see on Wild Chicago it really is a glimpse of a city at a different time. And there's a different feel. And more than that, it's, or just as important is, most of those places don't exist anymore. So you really see something that's a of historical value, I think, besides the funniness and coolness of the people. So.
And I think you're talking about the power of a mega city versus just a city. Like a person could do something different every day
That's true.
in a mega city like Chicago or New York or LA or something of that nature. It's very different than, many of the general cities. And I mean, no one, I'm not trying to make fun of people from Milwaukee or anything, but what I'm saying is Milwaukee or Raleigh or a Columbia, South Carolina. There's things to do, but they're just not as many things that
Well,
are to do.
consider this, gents. People often thought the show was about places. And I always thought, from my own experience, I didn't walk into it thinking this, but it became apparent very quickly, it's about the people. And
Absolutely.
it's about the enthusiasm and passion that these people had for what they were doing. And what many times what they were doing was eccentric and kind of out there. But their passion is what helped us, buy in and not feel afraid. Because they were, I mean, sometimes the crew was afraid of, in these places where I'd go. I'd go to this, like, this guy, Brendan DeValence. He was a performance artist. And he had this funny, like, industrial place near Chinatown. We went in to see him, and he did this bit where he read a letter aloud to Oprah Winfrey with a live chainsaw on his head, that was turned on. And these guys were going, oh, and there were like two assistants. He had these two assistants with him, and one was Carol and one was Merrill. Now, Carol Merrill used to be the woman on Let's Make a Deal, that sort of this, it was a game show back in the 60s and 70s. So here's Carol and here's Merrill. Both Carol and Merrill were, I believe, male, wearing these crazy hot black hot pants, and they were just like modeling stuff, like this. It was just so out there. And the rather conservative, I didn't know they were that conservative, but the two guys I was working with, who's seen everything in Chicago from their, voluminous experience out in the field, they were nervous. They didn't like being there. But I was connecting with Brendan DeValence, like, this guy's th this is my p these are my people,
And
and
that's what I
we
loved
connected.
about your career and Wild Chicago and those connections that you brought. You were the joy. You were finding the perspective of these people so fascinating, where the normal people wouldn't have ever met that guy. You went out there, you thought that there was something interesting, and you showed us what it would be like to take a moment and to have those conversations with normal, regular people on the street.
Open your eyes, get in touch with your curiosity, and then just walk right in. I always found, like, I definitely felt nervous at times walking into places where I didn't know anybody, especially in the early part of my career. But I relied on some improv theater training I got. And one thing was just like, increase your energy. Bring some enthusiasm to it. Like, just for me, telling myself, buy in and see what happens. So I'm naturally effusive around people, and I like to smile, and I like people. And I just, the guy's all, whatever, this guy's dressed in all leather and he makes leather underwear, whatever. I seem to be doing a lot of leather talk. I don't know why,
It's aiming toward right for our audience right
yeah, there you go.
there.
But however, whatever the situation was, I was not emitting a sense of like, oh, this is kind of strange. No, it's like, hey, how are you? Like, look him in the eye, put my hand out. And you remember, I often would say, so tell us who you are and where we are. And then they just start telling us about themselves. And it's very disarming. And they feel comfortable to just start, telling us what they do. We love it.
So tell us a little bit about your improv training and maybe how that helps bring out or helps highlight the person that you were interacting with.
I'll tie it to one of the first things that I got in terms of some coaching notes from John Davies, who was the co-creator with me and had TV experience and I didn't. And those first episodes, he actually got a credit. We gave him a credit for director because he was there directing me and helping me know what to do. But one thing he said along the lines of your question is, Ben, remember, you're not the star of Wild Chicago. Wild Chicago is the star of Wild Chicago. And that took a lot of pressure off me because I was scared and nervous in those first days. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. But I never had to do a direct thing to the camera except for the introduction for the show, which I only had to do a couple of times. Then we cut it together and it was done. It was on tape and it was the same thing every week. I'd walk into the places and I could, the improv part of it was connect with the person I'm talking to. That was probably the first thing. Bring energy. Another note from the program director, Dick Bowman, was he said to John Davies, we gotta find a way to get more energy into Ben, which might, you know, amuse people today because their memories of me from the show would be like me running into places.
Literally. Well,
I literally ran into places that the first time I did it was because I was consciously going, this will get my energy up. And once my energy's up, I can trust that the whole process will just unfold, which it does. And also I'll tie in what Davey said to me about, like, I'm not the star. Therefore, let's go in as equals and let's together create something that has no script, because I didn't have a script. They didn't have a script. I had some questions prepared, but we together will make something wonderful and interesting.
And you did.
That was part of the improv too.
You absolutely did, Ben.
So once the show gets started, I mean, you had a number of shows under your belt. Would you still seek out the unique people of the Chicago area? Or did you ever get to a point where things are given to you? Like, you need to show up in Northbrook, or you need to show up. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Today in the social media world, there's a lot about community, you know, building a community. And we know how that happens. This is pre-internet, pre-social media and everything. We had a little tag at the end of every show. Tell us about your Wild Chicago. Write it down and send it to, I mean, this is sounds like ancient worlds, but that's how we got people to send in stuff. And it worked right off the bat. Right away, we started getting envelopes, packages, stuff. You got to see this, you got to go here. And it never stopped coming. So that was big. And a community was building in a way that we really couldn't track it so well because of technology.
I was out there, Ben. I was out there listening.
Yeah, this is what happens. It's just such a genius. I mean, what a gift from the universe. Like, I did this show more than 30 years ago and people still will come up to me and say, you know, I saw you, I loved the show. Or I saw it with my dad, you know, when I was a kid. Like, so multi-generational, that means I can probably get this kind of connection with people to the grave, you know? I'm not going to outlive the fans.
And my style certainly is predicated upon yours. That idea of finding people. Chip and I both are very much people that like people. And we find strangers and come up with conversations and bring joy to finding out about the perspective of another person. And I credit you for a lot of my thinking in that way, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's what a blessing to just see it materializing in the world today with you and other people too. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as the show once again continued to go on, did you find people that were kind of evergreens that you would revisit because, you know, maybe a festival was going on, you know, at this point, but we were going to come back to it next year or the year after because you found what you were looking for?
That's a great question. I don't, I don't think we did. I think we had a pretty strong sense of we do a piece on somebody and then we savor it and that's it, you know. I mean, there were a couple of recurring bits, which was our version of Man on the Street was a piece called Dumb Question. And it was just coming up with a silly question like, you know, why the chicken crossed the road. I mean, really, we really, literally did that one, I remember once. Or on Belmont by the L, I asked people, what's the wildest place you've been to in Chicago? But that was a way of going back to something that seemed to work. Also, from a production point of view, very easy to produce. No B-roll, really. Just hard cuts. You guys were talking earlier off mic about the pleasure of hard cuts. What'd you call them? Jump cuts?
Yeah, your
Or
jump cuts,
yeah,
your
jump cuts.
style,
I mean,
absolutely. The voiceover and then the hard jump cuts between all of these images of
yeah.
these things that we probably would never see if you didn't go there with a camera. How did you get that style? Where did that style come from? Is that you, or was that your crew? How did that come about?
Okay, couple of things. One is, like many many cases behind the scenes, you don't realize it, but something is the mother of invention is necessity or something like that.
Necessity is mother of invention. Yes, sir.
Something like that. The show had like zero budget, so we knew we had to edit the show fast and in a room that actually, I don't know whether it was equipped to do anything but jump cuts, hard cuts. We certainly had no special effects in there. We might have been able to do a dissolve, but we just were contemptuous of dissolves. So that's why it looked the way it did, because we were under the gun. When we started the show, we really thought, okay, we're gonna spend one tape on the location. The tapes were 22 minutes long at that point. They were 3/4-inch tapes. And we told the camera guy, start rolling, you know, as Ben starts running into the place, and don't turn the camera off until we tell you to. Well, the camera guy loved that. He knew he was going to be in and out of there in 30 minutes, you know. There'd be a stop around the 20-minute mark. We always said, let us know when there are a couple of minutes left, because that's when we have to do what we call the close, where we say, so tell us when you're open here, what are your hours of operation? And then we'd have this like long shot of the camera guy like covering a lot of stuff, whatever was there. He'd shoot it in a running shot up right up to the two of us, me and the guy who's telling, or the woman who's telling me about the place and their hours, and she or he reels off the information, and then that's the end of it. And then it's bang, 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 bang to one of those transitions of those fast moving shots with a lot of good audio. So
That
yeah,
frenetic pace
frenetic
that
pace.
you
Oh.
came in with and the editor came in with, it just matched up so well.
Well, those guys had experience. You know, Harvey Moshman was one of the first. He was the first editor who had a lot of experience, and he had some great tricks about making things go. And then John Davies had an encyclopedic knowledge of past gonzo kind of video operations, and he had a lot of great tips. He picked up some tip from B Hollywood B movie guy who said, here's what you gotta always either keep the camera moving or keep what's in the frame moving. But no, if you stand still, never stand still for more than a couple of seconds, and then something's got to happen.
Oh, you know what? I just came to an amazing epiphany. I like B movies and I like Ben Hollis's style, and maybe those two things might be tied together.
Maybe, Steve.
Maybe, maybe.
Maybe this time in your life you're a trove. Now, Ben, it sounds like you were an innovator also, with early websites where you could rent a friend.
Oh yeah.
So rentafriend.com was a thing.
No, it's a thing right now. Do you know about this, Ben? That there's a
Yeah.
rentafriend.com that took your concept and ran with it?
I know. Where you can actually rent a friend for $10 or something, and they'll have coffee with you. You have to sign something that says that this is not a romantic or sex thing.
Right.
It's just about being a
Just
friend.
friends. So Ben had a VHS tape of just him sitting in a chair for over 40 minutes and being just the friend in the room with you via VHS. Now you could really rent a friend and they can go and go to your soiree with you. I just love, maybe a
That's
cotillion.
pretty nuts. That was a great thing. I love that. And you can see it. It's actually somebody put it up on YouTube with my permission, and it's there. And then we're talking about longevity and people remembering me from Wild Chicago. Rent-A-Friend came out before Wild Chicago, 1986, 87, in there. And that was just a couple of years before the first show aired on TTW in 1989. But Rent-A-Friend has gotten discovered by like modern day people,
Modern
like
people.
the Found Footage Festival.
Okay.
And there's two guys who go around the country finding weird old VHS tapes and picking out the best of them and the and little snippets, and cutting it together and making an entertaining evening, like in Chicago at the Music Box Theater or the Alamo Theater. And I thought, this is so up my alley, because I'm all about like people as is, and just not dolled up, no press releases. So I went to go see these guys, loved their show, and I said, you guys gotta see Rent-A-Friend. And I set him up with Rent-A-Friend, and it turned out Nick actually said, I actually ran into Rent-A-Friend on my hunt the other day at a resale shop or a
Wow.
Salvation Army or something. And I was wondering about it. And then serendipitously, I came to a show. Anyway, the short end is they loved it. They started showing Rent-A-Friend to their audiences. And then I started giving them Wild Chicago clips, and they've thrown that in there too.
Fantastic.
Well, it sounds like the type of event that Wild Chicago would have loved to have found at that time. Because, I mean, it seems like a brilliant concept. You find a bunch of VHS tape. They are, people are dressed differently, doing different things. And just like kids use YouTube or TikTok or whatever, it's just they went and
A
did
time capsule.
odd things.
I was going to say, we did that was unusual. Well, we had a kind of a whimsical style sheet about what we do, what we don't do. And we definitely didn't do celebrities, but we or places that were famous. We sort of made a pact that we would never do anything on Michigan Avenue, or anything that was represented by a big time PR agency. But I'm just remembering, and that's funny because as I'm remembering it, maybe this could segue to something else. I'm remembering some pieces we did that weren't from Wild Chicago. They were from Ben Loves Chicago, which was a show that came later on Channel 50. But in the spirit, really, it was very much a spirit of Wild Chicago idea. Say Jay Leno was coming to town and he was doing a book signing. Well, we would go to that so that we could talk to the people standing in line waiting to see Jay, because
Sure.
they probably had interesting stories. And all we needed was a quick shot of Jay to do that, to sell it, like as a, like look at this, to get the star value. We did that with Jenny McCarthy too, who was a starlet for a while, married to another. Anyway, all my references now are like, whoa, they tell too much.
The idea of story catching, that's the idea in the Chicago book by Brian Doyle. And I think of you as that story catcher. You weren't a storyteller as much as going out there and finding those stories. What's your philosophy of life? Where do you stand with story catching in the 21st century?
Well, that's a good one, because I think it's very much on my mind in a way. I always seem to be, as you said, kind of a a concierge or an impresario and like to bring you stuff. And I used to think, did I do that just because I didn't want to go full, you know, full steam as a performer myself? Because I have some talents in other areas too, but there's something exciting. You know, I know what it is. It just came to me. As a kid, I used to walk around and say, nobody tells me anything. And now I go around asking people and they tell me everything. And it's beautiful. And then now I'm in a place in a spiritual way that I don't think I'm actually separate from anybody else. It's mm-hmm. all, we're all just one big thing. So if I'm getting your story, you know, it's my story too. There's only one story. There's only one consciousness. I know it's getting woo-woo in here, but you know,
I'm with you.
Wait a second. Are we turning on the light and putting on opening the hookah bar stage?
I assume that you've read or seen the video of the egg, the philosophical discussion of this idea of we are all one person, and every person that you meet is you, and you should treat them with a degree of respect that you would treat yourself.
You know,
just by the reason that they exist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an interesting.
Well, when you think about it, look, it's like there's just this one big crazy swirl of something going on here, and we're all in it. Now, it's comical, I think, for a person, a human being, to think that, to go around spouting, everything's connected, except me, you know? Like, they are somehow the exception. Oh, but nobody's as bad as me, you know, or nobody's greater than me. No, it's just all bozos on the bus. And you know what? I didn't know that I knew this back in those wild Chicago days. It's sort of just come together, which makes everything make perfect sense when you look back, you know?
I'm totally with you. Andy Weir is the author of that short story, The Egg, and it absolutely speaks to my philosophy that we are all one person.
And yeah. Steve here is really understanding this because he understands Yoda and the Force.
And Ben Hollis. This is one of my Yodas in my life is watching Ben run around and interacting with people and bringing joy, bringing happiness, finding the joy in other people's stories is a big part of what I do all day long.
And Ben, if we wanted to find more about the projects that you're currently working on, we'll learn more about you, where would we find you?
The current place is that platform called Substack.
Yeah, you go to benhollis.substack.com and sign up for his, it's not a newsletter because this is the 21st century. We're not going to use a newsletter. The Substack is your voice of what you're doing and how you're doing it.
It started with me getting old tapes, video content also that had never been seen before. Sometimes it's personal or vacations or this, that. That might not sound very interesting to folks, but I got this stuff digitized and started looking at it, not as a way of like presenting the good old days or something, but more like, how do I respond to these images and these sounds today? What is going on here? And I called it, what the podcast or the Substack is called One Continuous Take, or it's the Ben Museum / One Continuous Take. And the One Continuous Take is a tip of the hat to the idea that like this is all just one continuous take that we're in right now, everything, and there's no beginning, there's no end. Just like a long take in a Hitchcock film, only that actually does have a beginning and an end. But here, consider this. I'm on an amazing streak, a winning streak. Count the days I've woken up in a row. I'm undefeated. Undefeated.
That's fantastic.
One day I won't wake up, but that's a different story. That's about consciousness.
We will have all of that material. We'll have all of those moments and
Oh,
being
yeah.
able to go back and being able to experience those moments that you gave us is a prize for your winning streak, sir.
No. Oh, well, hey, thank you. And that's great because that means to me that A, I did something right, and B, I'm doing something right to this day. And when I say I don't mean little ego I, but there's this, but the force is working, you know, and it's coming through, and it's going to touch people because, like they say, what comes from the heart touches the heart.
Absolutely.
And I hope. Oh, my ego's still in it to some extent because I love the idea that people can still get some benefit from this. But if the benefit is lightening your load for a couple of minutes or finding pleasure, yeah, have at it forever.
Joy. I say joy.
And that seems to be, as we came out of the as we've come out of the pandemic, one of the message was we need connection and we need to celebrate our time
And our stories.
Yes.
And a lot of people certainly their priorities are different than when they came into it. So anyway, it just gives us this another opportunity to celebrate people.
Yes.
Ben Hollis, thank you so much for 30 years of joy and spreading the word about Chicago and about the people and getting the idea of talking to people and seeing others' perspective.
You are most welcome, and thank you for calling attention to this. That means a lot. Thank you.
There's some interesting things on our calendar this week, Chip. It is the end of Ramadan today, so a joyous Ramadan to everybody. I hope you had a great month.
And another thing that we're celebrating, Steve, back in 1865, hey, the Civil War ended.
Today was the day that the Civil War, the South surrendered to the United States. So happy, welcome to the United States, everybody.
That's right. We're one big country, Steve.
In April 12th of 1776, we had the Halifax Resolves.
That's a big day here in North Carolina, Steve, and for the rest of the nation. The Halifax Resolves took place. It's one of the dates on the North Carolina flag. And it was the day that the United States or North Carolina asked for secession from England. It was the catalyst or one of the first, I'm sorry, it was the first request for independence from England.
So we're celebrating that. Let's celebrate everything. That's great. There is a bill being drafted in legislation in California to allow employees time to disconnect from work. This is an important issue for the 21st century.
It seems to be of interest. I know that France has a bill that's very similar to this, who basically says that when you leave work, you're not on call. That is, and that's where a lot of people have a very difficult time because of smartphones, because of connected technology. Many feel that they have to be on all the time. The idea here is to kind of create a break from that. I don't know if that works for American culture.
We'll see.
They're going to try it in California. Steve, they try a lot of things in California.
Absolutely. That is what I was thinking, was California is the catalyst for a lot of these ideas.
Speaking of Chicago and all the stuff we talked about, Steve, the University of Chicago actually published a paper this week. Steve, for 50 years, the University of Chicago, a professor there, has been asking, who are the happiest people, Steve? Who are those happy people?
And maybe the key to happiness is marriage, is the findings of this.
That is, and it's not just by a little bit. It's not like John was happier, but now he's a little bit happier. The difference is a significant spread between those who identify as happy and those who are married, and those who are not married. And so, could it be that being married to another person, sharing the experiences of life, is the key to happiness, Steve? I think there's a group of people in the United States that would like this information to be true, and they have a 50-year study
50 years. That's
showing that, once again, it's not just a little bit happier, it's significantly happier.
That is a brilliant thought process there.
30 percentage points happier than unhappy than unmarried people. That's not just a little bit. So there's a lot to this, and certainly the link is in our notes. But go get married, Steve.
Done. Check. Next.
Now, Steve, we got another thing that's really exciting because we get to meet so many wonderful people. And you remember Deidre Struck from the Lascivious Biddies?
Yes, I do.
Well, she's got a new album coming out on April 10th. And she has a live performance in New York. If you're in New York, you can go see it. But you can also log in and watch it from your home. So there's a way to see that through the green room. And we've got the link in our notes, in which we say the album is called The Year of Lost and Found, a panned opera. So it's a pandemic opera?
Pandemic opera. A Year of Lost and Found is a brilliant, that's a brilliant title.
And if you've never listened to, well, certainly you've heard, if you've been listening to us, you've listened to her music. But she has got incredibly clever lyrics and a wonderful pianist.
All right. Lots of things coming up. Tax day is Monday. Get your taxes in, everybody.
Yeah, Steve likes to get paid, right?
Right. That is certainly part of my thinking on tax day is, yes, the people that work for off the tax dollars would like you to pay up, please. Welcome to Chicago.
Pay and pay often, right?
That's right. We'd like to thank Ben Hollis for coming in and discussing Chicago and wild Chicago and the joy of us being together and finding our stories. Thank you so much for that moment. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
I think we can. There's no more eclipses, right?
No more for a while, Steve.
We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on all the social medias. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Survivor Chip Essenflow.
See you in the future. You're gonna make it?
The sun went away, Steve.